Ethan Russell was just 23 years old in 1968, an American expat living in London, when Rolling Stone magazine asked him to photograph Mick Jagger. It turned out to change the course of his life. Traveling to 16 different cities in 1969 from November 7th through December 6th, Mr. Russell followed the Stones on their breakthrough Let It Bleed American tour, capturing pretty much every moment along the way. The tour culminated in the violent concert at Altamont, which for many symbolized an explosive ending to the summer of love. In the 40 years since, Ethan Russell has earned numerous Grammy nominations for his photography and the music videos he's directed, working with the likes of Emmylou Harris, Paul Simon, and Joni Mitchell. A photographic compilation of his time with the Rolling Stones called Let It Bleed, The Rolling Stones, Altamont, and the End of the 60s has just been published by Springboard, and a selection of the images are in an exhibit that opens today at the Morrison Hotel Gallery at 313 Bowery. I'm very pleased that all of that brings Ethan Russell to our show today. Hi.
Hi, nice to be here.
How did you meet the Rolling Stones?
I was actually went to London totally by chance and stayed because I was intrigued with being there and was living by myself. I knew really nobody in London, and working on a hospital with autistic children, when somebody asked me if I wanted to meet a fellow called Jonathan Cott. I wasn't a photographer. I was sort of at loose ends, and he asked me if I wanted to photograph Mick Jagger. He turned out to be an interviewer for the Rolling Stone magazine, and that's how I got started.
Well, why would he even ask you to photograph Mick Jagger?
I had a couple pictures. When I was at the University of California, I was an art and English major, and one of the things that I did was taught how to develop black and white film, and I had a camera. And I had some pictures. My brother managed a group called Blue Cheer in San Francisco, and I had two pictures of Blue Cheer, and the rest were pictures of children. But that was adequate, apparently.
But you were already a fan of the Stones, even though they were a relatively new band.
Well, not from their perspective. I mean, I think they've been 63, 64, and I'd been listening to them since 65. I was in the university when I first saw the Rolling Stones. I was also in the university when I first heard I Want to Hold Your Hand. But I had been enmeshed in the music, really going back to really the start of this for everybody, including the Rolling Stones, is Chuck Berry and that era of rock and roll, which was my era.
Well, all of these people wind up in this story.
They do.
Which is interesting. And it's always weird when you're a fan and you're also doing a job.
It is. Because I didn't have a point of view other than to try and take what was in front of me. It was really what I was capable of. I think the big value of my photographs over time is that I never ask anyone to look at the camera. They're not overly aware of me. And so you do absolutely get the ability to feel like you were there. And that's what I think the work gives you.
And I get the sense, looking at these pictures, that after you were around so much, they even forgot that you were there.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's right. And we were very small. I mean, one of the unique things were there were only 16 people on that tour. And as someone said, the makeup department is larger than that now. There were 5 Rolling Stones and 11 other people, so it was a very small group.
You also photographed Brian Jones,
right.
One of the original Stones, in his country home, which had formerly been owned by A.A. Milne, the creator of Winnie the Pooh. And not long after you took those pictures, he died under mysterious circumstances.
Yes. I mean, I think there's talking about opening that up again. He died, and the official report at the time was death by misadventure, I believe is the coroner's description of what happened.
But it was assumed he had taken drugs and then drowned?
Well, that was the sort of de facto explanation, and it may well be the real explanation. He was, some of the pictures I have of him, he looked 26 years old and he looked 52 easily, if not older, 60. So he was a combination of being quite a gentleman on occasion, like children, could be extremely sweet, and he could be violent, and he was very, very druggy.
For a photographer with limited background in photography, you wound up shooting an awful lot of interesting people. You photographed the Beatles in the last photo session before they broke up.
And all of Let It Be before that as well.
Because now Rolling Stone looked to you as their London photographer?
Absolutely not, actually. It was a very small... I was not a Rolling Stone photographer. I did 2 sessions while Jan Wenner was publishing them in Rolling Stone. He put me on the masthead, and I asked him to take me off the masthead. I was working with the groups directly. The groups were the people that were asking me to work for them. Apple asked me to work for them to do those pictures. Yeah, I think it was a very small crowd, really. I mean, the Rolling Stones would watch what the Beatles were doing. The Beatles were watching what the Rolling Stones were doing. And I,
it was kind of like Matisse and Picasso.
Yeah, only audio, right? And so right after I photographed Mick, I was asked to photograph John Lennon. That was by virtue of the Rolling Stone magazine.
Well, it sounds to me like you were doing quite well, but that you decided to return to California. Why?
Because I'm a Californian, because I think everybody goes home at a certain point, and I'm somewhat motivated to believe that you do what matters to you rather than what seems to be the fashion, and I felt like going home, so I went home.
And then you reunited with the Stones.
Yeah, I knew everybody. They were my friends, and not only were they my friends, but more to the point, the people that surrounded them were my friends. They were the same crew.
Were your parents pleased when you told them that you were going to Los Angeles to live with a rock and roll band?
I don't know that they had an opinion about it. They didn't express it. But they came to our house. I mean, my father had a horse ranch, and Jagger heard about it. Beautiful house. My step-grandmother was a Crocker, which is a banking family, and he heard about
the
it.
The Crocker and, Bank?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to see it, so they flew up and spent a weekend at the ranch and gambled with my father all night.
But you wound up living in this little Rolling Stones community in Los Angeles.
Yeah, yes, it was. There were really only two houses, and Charlie Watts and the Ronnie Schneider, who was the business manager, and I and various others were in one house, and Mick and Keith and Mick Taylor were in Stephen Still's house on the other side of the valley.
My staff wants to know who won when they gambled.
The Rolling Stones won and didn't pay their debts is the answer.
And they've just told me thank you. Okay. So you wound up living in one of these. It was kind of like the spirit of the 60s. Everything was communal, even when we're talking about superstars.
Well, it wasn't, because there's not this sort of equal sign between the English and the Americans. So the Americans thought it was one thing and the English thought it was another. And so it was small. I think that was probably driven as much by the cost factor of it. The Rolling Stones had very little money on with which to put this tour on.
Really? They were riding high. They were one of the most popular bands in the world at that point.
They had just fired Alan Klein, and Alan Klein had frozen all their assets.
Ah. My guest is Ethan Russell, who's Let It Bleed, The Rolling Stones, Altamont, and The End of the 60s is published by Springboard. There's also an exhibition of photographs from it on view until December 31st at the Morrison Hotel Galleries at 313 Bowery. And you can see a slideshow on our website at wnyc.org. You were just one of 16 people in the on the tour, and that included the band members. So who else was in the non-band cast of characters, as you call them?
Well, if you sort of in diminishing order of importance or ending with me, let's say, there was Ian Stewart, who was one of the original Rolling Stones. Ian Stewart was a Scotsman, played piano, still traveled with him. So Stu, as Stanley Booth, who was the writer, so I'll put him next, called Stu the Only Grown-Up. And he was, so it was Stu and Stanley Booth, who was a writer, Michael Lydon, who was a writer, Ronnie Schneider, who was Alan Klein's nephew, who was the business manager for the tour, Samuel Cutler, who was an Englishman, who was the sort of road manager for the tour, me, Joe Bergman, who ran the Rolling Stones office, and I think that's all of them. Oh, Tony Funches, who was security, and they all have extraordinary stories that get them there. They're all sort of plucked out of their lives and asked to go on the tour. Changed everyone's life.
And this is a really intense tour, going from place to place in very brief times.
Yeah, baseball
teams get to stay in a town for a few days.
Yeah, I think there were a couple of layoffs, but not much. It was sort of every night, one after the other. It was very unique as a tour, and I don't think that was known at the time, wasn't by me. The Rolling Stones were paying the other acts. That had never happened. They were traveling with their own stage. That had never happened. They were traveling with lights. That had never happened. So they were playing coliseums like Madison Square Garden or the Los Angeles Coliseum, and that was all sort of new for a rock and roll band to do. It's all Jagger's credit that he did that.
And the other people on the tour included Chuck Berry, B.B. King, Tina Turner, Terry Reid. We're talking about pretty big stars in their own right. And I'm assuming there was some kind of cross-fertilization musically.
Well, yes, but although it was interestingly the sort of structure of it, I only saw Barry come backstage once. I only saw visit the Stones dressing room, and same with B.B. King. But it's a tribute to them that that's the Rolling Stones hired them. That's who they liked. That's who they wanted to travel with.
You admit to attempting to hit on one of Tina Turner's backup singers.
Yes, and then Mick came by and sort of stood next to her, and she left with him.
He did. Oh, I see. Well, you were a low man on the totem pole.
Yes, I was. It was pretty clear.
The Stones wanted to end their tour with a free concert. Why was that important to them?
Well, I think there was, you know, as Keith Richards said that that the free concerts were the style of the time. But they had been criticized and were sensitive to the criticism that their ticket prices were too expensive. And they had come over. There's a lot about this in the book, where the English are sort of being asked by the American youth, the quote from Mick Jagger, which I thought was good, which was, you can't tell by looking anymore. You know, when you look at the press people that are interviewing them, they now look like the Rolling Stones, the underground press. And they wanted to know that they were on their side. They wanted to know that they were behind them when there were riots in Chicago. They wanted to know. And Mick was always uncomfortable with those kind of questions because he's an Englishman and it wasn't their war. But to answer that question as much as possible, the free concert was part of it, and they wanted to give something back. I genuinely believe that.
And do you think it's significant that they chose the Altamont Speedway to present that concert?
They didn't choose it. It's something that happened. Because of altercation with Bill Graham, I think they couldn't get to be in San Francisco. They were in another location, which was taken away 3 days before. So part of the Altamont story was it was an announced free concert. You could imagine 400,000 people showing up, and there was no location.
And so, there were a lot of altercations. You witnessed Mick Jagger getting punched in the face by a fan when you first arrived at Altamont.
I heard about that. I was in the second helicopter, but that was what happened. He got off a plane, and a kid came up to him and hit him in the face and said, "I hate you." It was the first thing that happened.
So things were spiraling out of control way before the band even got out on the stage.
Way before the band got there. And Marty Balin was knocked out, pulled off stage and knocked out. Jefferson Airplane, an earlier act.
You were vulnerable with the camera. Were you worried for your safety?
I was worried. Everybody that was, you know, had any sense was worried. It was a very dark and violent atmosphere.
Well, I'm not going to get into all the reasons that Hell's Angels were asked to do the security, because that's been discussed many times. But they had worked for the Stones before and without any incident.
Well, not really. It's this issue of thinking that English and American are the same. There were Hell's Angels at the Rolling Stones free concert in Hyde Park in London, but the reality is they were probably have photographs of it. You can't argue with the photographs. They're probably 14 years old, 16 years old. They probably go home to their parents. They're not Hell's Angels. But they were dressed like that, and really the Rolling Stones didn't know the difference.
What was running through your mind when you heard that Meredith Hunter, a spectator who pulled out a gun and was heading for the stage, was stabbed to death by one of the Hells Angels?
I think it hit me. It didn't hit me as viscerally as until I saw the film, because in the Maisel Brothers film Gimme Shelter you can actually see that stabbing, and I 40 years later can barely watch it. It's really the guy's being killed in front of you. It's a truth, though, that as part of doing this book and the investigation and talking to the detectives that reopened the case as a cold case, that if the Hells Angels had not been beating people up all afternoon, and when one says the Hells Angels, you have to actually, you know, also say that there were prospects, people that wanted to be Hell's Angels that may well have been sort of trying to show how tough they were. It was an out-of-control situation, but not all Hell's Angels were violent, and it's possible if there hadn't been as much violence going on prior to that moment that the actual stabbing of that kid, he was holding a gun, he was pointing at the stage. There's an entire group of people that thinks that Hell's Angel saved one of the Rolling Stones' lives, and a lot of people believe that. It's arguably the case.
Many people have wondered how, just months after Woodstock, which was another, turns out, free concert, although it hadn't been intended as such, but where everything was done so peacefully, despite the possibility of violence, why this happened here and not there.
I think the answer, I got to tell you, I think the answer is drugs and alcohol. I think that San Francisco was ahead of the East Coast in that way. They sort of started the movement, the hippie movement, earlier, and it sort of progressed in terms of drug taking faster. And there was you have to look at all the parties at that particular event. There were the Rolling Stones, who were actually really a small player. They were 2 days before, they were in a recording studio in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and they knew absolutely nothing about it. And the Hells Angels had responsibility, and the people that came and would fall over because they were so loaded on one thing or another and knock over Hells Angels' bikes had some responsibility as well.
So what happened? The Stones went right back to England.
They left the next morning.
Did you talk to any of them? Had they been shattered?
No, I didn't. I got home to that same hotel that they were in. They were already in their rooms. When I got up the next morning, they were gone. They were out of the country.
Have all of these photographs been shown before?
Not really. This book took me 6 years to do, and about 60 or 70% of it has never been published.
Were you surprised by some of the things you came up with?
Yeah, it was a personal journey. I mean, I was as shocked by that experience and the ending, the sort of concussive quality of Altamont. And I believe and still believe that, except for my own sort of exploration, it hasn't really been taken in by my generation.
But this led you to a whole new career. You've done music videos and other things.
Well, I never, if we go back to the beginning of the interview, I never really wanted to be a photographer. It wasn't what I wanted to be. And what I wanted to be was a writer. And so but what sucked me in was the writing qualities and the music of the 60s. And as that got to be more diffuse and would sort of diminish as it did after this, and then as it did after the sort of traditional next generation singer-songwriters like the Eagles, I got less interested in being a photographer of it. But I was interested in trying to tell stories. So I tried to take what I did as a photographer and turn it into film.
Ethan Russell's book, Let It Bleed, The Rolling Stones, Altamont, and the End of the 60s, is published by Springboard. You can see some of the photographs in an exhibit at the Morrison Hotel Galleries at 313 Barry, and also check out our website at wnyc.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me.